good afternoon, late afternoon. I gather we'll start the program. I'd first like to thank Frank Dotson, the director of the Black Cultural Center here, Bishop Johnson Black Cultural Center, for allowing the history department and myself here for this event, New Faculty Research in Black Atlantic History. I'm Tracy Sharpley Whiting, the director of African American and Diaspora Studies and professor of French and Italian. And I will take a moment to introduce our panelists and then turn the floor over. And I gather we'll, I don't know if we're going in order or out of order, but I'll just introduce them. After a while, you should be able to figure out gender. Dr. Anastasia Kerwood earned her PhD in history from Princeton University in 2003. She joined the faculty in African American and Diaspora Studies here at Vanderbilt in the fall of last year. Well, actually just last fall. It sounds like it's so far away, but it was just last fall. She specializes in the history of gender, sexuality, and the family in African American history with a particular focus on the early 20th century. Currently, Dr. Kerwood is at work on a manuscript entitled Stormy Weather, New Negro Marriages, 1918 to 1940. And we were going to talk a little bit about what she was going to teach, but there's not many students here, so I'm going to skip that part there. So, nonetheless, but for those who are interested, though, she will be teaching, a very interesting course on African-American biography and sexuality next year, besides a freshman seminar a course on African-American women and African-American migration. So those will be her courses next year, nonetheless. Her talk today will be, of course, on, well, you did change your title a bit, right?
No, really. I think it's the same.
It's the same, okay. Yeah. Stormy Weather, New Negro Marriages, 1918 to 1940. Okay. Professor Jane Landers is an associate professor of history and formerly associate dean of the College of Arts and Science and director of the Center for Latin American and Iberian Studies at Vanderbilt.
Formerly?
Okay. All right. She teaches Latin American colonial history, Atlantic world history, and courses on comparative slave system. Her research has been supported by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Conference on Latin American History, and the Program for Cultural Cooperation between Spain's Ministry of Culture and the United States Universities. She is author of Black Society in Spanish Florida, editor of Colonial Plantations and Economy of Florida, and Against the Odds, Free Blacks and the Slave Societies of the Americas, and co-editor of Slaves, Subjects, and Subversive Blacks in Colonial Latin America, and of the African American Heritage of Florida. She has published essays in the American Historical Review, Slavery and Abolition, the New West Indian Guide, the Americas and Colonial Latin American Historical Review. Her work also appears in a variety of anthologies and edited volumes. Landers is on the International Advisory Board of the Harriet Tubman Center for Research on the African Diaspora and on the editorial boards on the Americas and Slavery and Abolition. She consults on a variety of archaeological projects, documentary films, and museum exhibits, and also directs an NEH collaborative research project to collect Black sacramental records in Cuba and Brazil, the oldest serial documents for African history in the Americas. She has researched Black history in the archives of Spain, Mexico, Cuba, Colombia, Ecuador, Brazil, and the Dominican Republic, as well as the United States, and is currently working on two monographs, one on which she is speaking today, and a second on Maroon communities around the Spanish Caribbean. Moses Ochun received his PhD in 2004 from the University of Michigan. He specializes in the economic, political, and social history of modern Africa, especially Africans' experiences of European colonialism and their aftermath. Professor Ochun has published an article on Henri Barthes, a mid-19th century German-British explorer in northern Nigeria, and another on the activities and discourses of an African's reactions to British medics in northern Nigeria. His current research focuses on the socioeconomic and political impacts of the Great Depression on colonial northern Nigeria. He is also interested in the role of African auxiliaries and elites in colonialism. And last but not least is, of course, Dan Usner. He is the chair of history. And Dan, I don't have your title, your long title as a named chair in history, so I did not receive a blurb, but suffice it to say he's a grand man. Who works on, is it Creoles and Native Americans in Louisiana,
yes.
Right? Wonderful work. So I'll just stop there and
he's a big tubob, as they would say in Senegal.
He will be doing, I guess, closing remarks.
Okay. Do I get to go?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
it's absolutely fitting that I'm talking about my topic today, African-American marriages, because it's Valentine's Day as well as being Black History Month. So this actually goes very, very well. I'm doing double duty. As Professor Sharpe Whiting said, my topic is Stormy Weather, New Negro Marriages, 1918 to 1940. The title refers to not only a song and a film, Stormy Weather, and I'll get to those in a minute, but also the turbulence over the definitions and the meanings of African-American marriages in this era, in 1918 to 1940. It was the tie between two world wars and covers the Harlem Renaissance, or what some call the New Negro Renaissance, and it covers the Great Depression, that time of great economic turmoil in the United States. So this was a very eventful period. By New Negro and New Negro marriages, I'm referring to a term that's old. P. Diddy did not invent it, even though he has a t-shirt that says New Negro on it. That's actually a very old term, from this time in the 1920s. The idea behind the New Negro is a little bit of demographics, educated and self-supporting, economically independent men and women, but the New Negro also was a psychological person, or is a psychological term. Self-determination, self-definition. This term often gets cast in sort of masculinist terms, like militancy, doing battle, standing up for yourself, and male self-determination. So it's got this masculinist overtone as well. Now, marriage was important to this self-definition, both the demographic and the psychological one. However, there was not so much agreement on what marriage should be and what the definition of marriage should be. New Negroes thought of marriage in different ways. So there are at least three rough groups of people defining marriage at this time. And I'm going to talk about the definitions right now, and then I'm going to move into reality, because there's mythology and reality. Anyone here who's taken a course with me knows that mythology versus reality is a theme that I like to explore, and so I'm going to continue doing that today. So the mythology, the ideal. At least three groups of people had these ideals. One group was people I'm calling the New Negroes, and this is including some socialist radicals, some members of the literati, artists and writers at the time in the 1920s. And these New Negroes, the way they distinguished this idea basically was theorizing masculine superiority as an important component to these marriages. And I'll give you a couple of examples. For instance, Jean Toomer wrote a novel called Cain, which in some ways is credited with the beginning of the Harlem Renaissance. It was published in 1923. In the novel itself, there's a lot of gendered language, stereotypical versions of women. But Jean Toomer, in his personal life, had very strong ideas about what marriage should look like and how gender relations should look. So Jean Toomer, in his diary and in his later writings, wrote about how women should be trained to be the wives of geniuses, that it was very important for these new techniques of controlling reproduction and birth control, that women shouldn't think that that absolves them of responsibility to be supporters and wives. So that's Jean Toomer. Another person who I call a New Negro was the sociologist E. Franklin Frazier. And his version was not quite as retrograde as Jean Toomer's, although his version was also articulated more publicly. He thought that, by definition, a healthy family had to be a male-headed family. And there were two sorts of families that this wasn't working with. One was the matriarchal poor families of the urban north and of the south. And the other was middle-class families. where wives and husbands had a sort of egalitarian relationship. The first group, the matriarchs, he thought they would just die out because they'd moved to the city. Evolutionary processes of becoming urban, sophisticated African Americans would eventually lead men to pick up their rightful place as heads of the black proletariat family. And the problem with the middle class families was that they weren't showing any sign of changing. These middle class couples had two careers oftentimes so that they could afford to consume conspicuously. And his suspicion, he was an economic, a socialist radical in some ways, this isn't usually known about him, but he was very, very suspect of the middle class and of conspicuous consumption, and he thought women's roles as economic breadwinners in the families were solely to enable that. So the fact that women might want to work for themselves for their own purposes didn't enter into it. Now, there's another group of people who also define marriage at this time, and these are producers and consumers of popular culture. And this is where I'm going to talk about the film and the movie Stormy Weather. The film Stormy Weather came out in 1943, and it's the title of my manuscript and my talk today because it, in some ways, encapsulates all of these ideals about marriage. The basic story of this film goes like this. There's a character played by Bill Bojangles Robinson, and he is an up-and-coming entertainer. And he meets and falls in love with another female entertainer who's played by Lena Horne, the magnificent Lena Horne. They meet, they start to court, and then he says, well, now that my career is taking off, I can buy you a house, and you can just raise our children, and you won't have to work anymore. And she says, I don't want to do that. That's not what I had in mind. I would like to continue my career as an entertainer. So they break up. And she sings this song, Stormy Weather, which originally was sung most famously by Ethel Waters in the 1930s. But Lena Horne does a wonderful rendition. I'll play you a couple of verses. The lyrics go something like, don't know why there's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather. Since my man and I ain't together, keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere, stormy weather. Just can't get my poor old self together. I'm weary all the time, so weary all the time. So it continues like that, and I'll play you a few verses. And you will probably recognize the tune, and you'll see what a pop culture phenomenon this song was, as well as you'll hear the lyrics. So imagine Lena Horne, she's lovelorn, and she's because she's not together with her man because he doesn't agree with her career ambitions.
Oh.
Now, at the end of this scene, when she sings the song, she has a change of heart, and she decides that she does want to raise her children with Bill Robinson's character. And so all is well, and everything is happy again. The plot is thin. Basically, the film was a vehicle for virtuoso singing and dancing, and the singing and dancing are wonderful. But it's interesting that because they needed a plot to string all these songs and dances together, oh, well, we'll pick a stock plot. And that was very familiar to viewers. Now, the third group of people who were defining marriage, so we've had new Negroes, we've had popular culture, then there were new Negro feminists. And these were all women who thought that women's destinies lay not just in marriage, but in a combination of service to themselves, to the race, and to their families. So these were women like Sadie Tanner Moselle Alexander. She was a lawyer in Philadelphia, and she was a practicing lawyer. She wasn't so interested in housework. She wanted to do her career. But then there's Nannie Helen Burroughs, who was another very well-educated woman who founded a training school for domestic servants in order to dignify housework and to professionalize housework to make it get the respect that it deserved. Amy Jakes Garvey, Marcus Garvey's wife, who insisted that women have a role in activism. Elizabeth Diggs Slow, the Dean of Women at Howard University, who told women to get a classical education and not just study social work, but study sociology. So these were all women who saw that marriage was only one aspect of a woman's happy life. So this is what people were wrangling over. And then we have reality. So we've got this storm of ideals, and added to all of this mix-up was reality. This part of my work is intended to correct what I call the racial protocol. And actually, I didn't invent that term. The literary scholar Claudia Tate did. And basically, that dictates that all writing by and about black people should be about oppression, should be about racism. The story I'm telling, it's more about people's inner lives. It's seeing people as individuals, and it's a corrective, I feel, to seeing people just as units of race. I think that the inner lives of black Americans is worthy of study. So that's part of my goal in this second part of my project. Now, I'm going to read two excerpts from two letters to you. And these letters are full of the kinds of things that couples had to deal with in reality. So see, as I read, you might start a list in your head of the forces that they're dealing with. They're not necessarily dealing with racism on a day-to-day basis, but also on a day-to-day basis, they were talking about emotional realities for them. The letters I'm reading today are letters that my grandparents wrote to each other in the 1930s. One is from June 28, 1937, and the other one is from June 29, 1937. It's the response to the first one. And my grandparents, Sarah Kerwood and James Lawrence Kerwood, were living in Boston at the time, although James was commuting to Cohasset, Massachusetts, and working there most of the week and would come up on Thursdays. And Sarah had just gotten a job at a settlement house doing some social work. She had only recently graduated from Cornell University. So I will read two excerpts. This first letter was from Sarah to James. She said, "So I shall do my work there at the settlement house during July, and then if it is pleasing to all, I can continue doing volunteer work until something better turns up. One of the workers is married, so I doubt if that will be an objection. Incidentally, there are only two workers. All in all, I think all will be grand. I am very eager to be known as Mrs. James Lawrence Kerwood, because this two-name business ain't so hot." And by two names, it's her maiden name and her married name, and she had concealed her married name for some time. They'd been married a year at this point. "Pray with me that all will be well. My work for July, and maybe the rest of the year, will be to conduct a survey on Negro union workers. Sounds interesting, doesn't it? It will give me time to be a housewife, help you with your schoolwork, perhaps even go with you and take some shorthand and typing, and keep up the intellectual world. It will be pinch pennies for us, but I'd rather pinch a penny with you than share a dollar with anyone else. God willing, all will be fine. My main task will be to do the best job I possibly can during July, so as to make myself necessary to the group. Mr. Goodman wants the survey done, because he and the two workers are far too busy to do it, so in slips I. I am very grateful to you for having taken me to South Huntington Avenue through Back Way, through Tremont Street and Ruggles Street. Otherwise, I would not have known approximately where Whittier Street was, so in spite of the brick sidewalk and spike heels, I am thankful. Incidentally, I shall probably plan my own time for interviews, and I'm going to plan to interview you 1 or 2 hours every Thursday before dinner time at the Settlement House. You see, darling, I don't ever want it to be more than a week, if I can help it, that must go by before I see you. Honestly, I don't see how I manage to stay away months at a time from you. I must be growing wiser as I grow older and more sincerely in love with you and more actively interested in your welfare. So there's a little bit of mush that follows that. And then there's his response. My darling, first I read your dear sweet letter, then I talked to dear sweet you, and now I turn my pen to your desire. So all in all, so far the day has been delightful. Nowadays I write to you in the afternoon and read the Bible in the evening. I no longer go for a walk in the evening. I stay in my room. Somehow I feel closer to you by so doing. Sorry I forgot to bring that book you said I should read, for I fully mean to let you be my teacher, and as I am sure you can best teach me than any other, you see, I love you. It pained me a little bit, a very little bit, to learn you have at times envied and have been jealous of my abilities, but I was by far prouder to learn that you thought I possessed intellectual qualities than I was pained by your envy. I have known all along, ever since I met you, that you are the type of woman who is best suited to love and be loved by your husband, i.e. you are fitted for home life and not a career. Hence my anxiety to capture you. You would, of course, acquit yourself admirably in any field in which necessity entered you, but you will make a much finer wife than you will a social or business executive. That is why I am anxious to get going myself, so that I can give you a home to fuss with and in which you can entertain your club friends, etc. You naturally need to be busy. It is in your nature, but you actively need to be governed by you. You will make a swell club organizer in the church, and I am sure our members will adore you. You are so adorable. So it is all right with me if you wish to enter into domestic employment for a year or so until our bills are disposed of. We can earn $135 or so per month, and surely we can live off the $35 and pay $100 on account. At such a rate, we could alleviate ourselves of debt in 1 year, and in the meantime, I could be studying nights for my high school degree. Now, I don't know if you did make a mental list in your head of the issues between this young couple, but among others, there's work, class, money, skin color is an undertone. She was lighter than he was. And there's intimacy and sexuality. And all of those things are accessible through letters. These letters happen to be from my family, and they're the best collection of love letters, African-American love letters I've ever seen. But there are some in other collections throughout the United States. And all of these factors were part of the day-to-day lives of married couples, notwithstanding what others were saying they should be doing and what their marriages should look like. And one thing that there is in common, however, is the tension between gendered roles in both this real couple and also in the theories from those three groups that I talked about. I will stop here and cede the floor to my colleague, and hopefully we'll have time for questions and answers. Thank you.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Forgive me if I sound a little scattered and incoherent. I'm a little jet lagged from my trip. I just got back from Nigeria 3 days ago, so I'm a little tired and jet lagged, and I'm trying to catch up on everything. But I didn't want to disrupt this by backing out. So I managed to just scribble something. So I'm just going to say something on this project. Mostly I'm going to raise questions because this project is still very much at its infancy. I mean, so I just began this project. I came back with this stuff from the archives in Nigeria. I haven't even looked at them. And I have a whole bunch of stuff on this project that I haven't even looked at. So I haven't even, I just... for this very talk, I just read a few of the materials, but the project looks at the writings, the travel writings of northern Nigerian Muslim, mostly male travelers to Britain during the colonial period, the decade after colonialism, the 60s, and in the 70s as well. So basically what interests me about the writings of this group of travelers is the way in which they represent Britain, its sights, its sounds, its peoples, the way in which they conceive of Britain in their lives, the way in which they interpret the colonial situation and their position within it. How does Britain and travel to Britain function within their social imagination, within their political struggles back in northern Nigeria. These writings were mostly done in the form of letters, articles, and stories in Hausa language newspapers, mostly in Hausa language newspapers in northern Nigeria. One of the newspapers in which most of these writings, these travel writings, these narratives of experiences in Britain was a newspaper called Gaskia Tafi Kwabo, which literally just means that truth is worth more than a penny, something like that. And it was published, it was started by the British in 1939 as as a tool of propaganda against the Germans, because the Germans were in the Cameroons next door to Nigeria, and they set it up to sort of mobilize northern Nigerians to support the British war effort. And as a propaganda tool against the Germans. But increasingly, it became, in northern Nigeria, the foremost literary vehicle through which people expressed their literary ideas, people told stories. It became very vibrant. It took on a life of its own. And the British, who set it up, actually lost control of it because it became really the number one vehicle through which people could share ideas, share stories and experiences. And the publication of stories of travel became very huge, especially of travel to the West, not just to Britain, but you know, other parts of Europe, and also to Mecca, the Holy Land, because these were Muslim, for the most part, the newspaper enjoyed a Muslim audience or readership. Most of these travelers were mostly people who had elite status, people who could afford to travel. They were people who were officials in the colonial bureaucracy, or people who were chiefs or kings. Some of us who are familiar with the workings of colonialism in Africa knows that if you were a chief or a king, you were paid by the British and you were incorporated into the colonial bureaucracy as a participant. One other thing that I will say about the travel was that they were of two kinds. Some of the travels were sponsored by the government, by the British colonial government. I'm still trying to figure out why they did that, but one thing that I found was that, and this is the connection between this project and my main project on the impact of the Depression on Northern Nigeria, was that the British, during the hardship of the Depression, they were sponsoring some of these trips to Britain to try to get these travelers to go to Britain to showcase to them what I would like to call imperial modernity, to try to awe them and impress them to such an extent that they could sort of glory in the grandeur, in the prestige of empire, and at least temporarily forget about their troubles, their miserable conditions back home, and basically to just impress them into, because they were the kings and the chiefs were the and the elites were the mouthpiece through which people voiced their concerns and their criticisms of the state, and there were so many criticisms. I mean, this it was a huge wave of criticism. So my theory about these sponsored travels at least in the 1930s, was that the British tried to put it crudely, buy off the chiefs and the kings and the elites so that they would face less criticisms with regards to their handling of the Great Depression. Okay. The other kind of travel was the self-sponsored ones. Mostly, you know, some of these elites, like I said, there were people who were deeply involved in colonial trade. In colonial, they were empowered by the British. They were given largesse, all kinds of largesse. They were given trade concessions. They were given contracts. They were financially empowered. Some of them were people of means. Some of them owned lorries, which was a big deal in colonial times. So some of them could afford to actually sponsor themselves on those trips. Some of them would pass through London. Some of them would go to Dublin and other places within Britain on their way to Mecca. And some of them would pass through Britain on their way from Mecca, from the Holy Land, after performing the pilgrimage. But some of them actually just went to Britain and came back. Some of them just wanted to travel to Britain because it was an experience that was cherished by most northern Nigerians at this time. So one thing I would like to say about this, even in the case of both the sponsored and the self-sponsored travels, one of my tentative working hypotheses is that these travelers were using this, which was their way of working the colonial system, as it were. This was a pragmatic way of engaging with the colonial system and reaching an accommodation with it, a beneficial accommodation. This was their way of ingratiating themselves, for instance, with the colonial establishment, of, you know, making friends with colonial officials. One of the things that I find fascinating about these travel narratives is how fondly the writers speak of their friendships with the British colonial officials. Conventional wisdom would tell us that, you know, they shouldn't want to associate with them, you know, they shouldn't want to associate with these officials when these officials left northern Nigeria, when they went back to England, because every official stayed for 3 years or 4 years and they had to go back to England. But they would speak fondly of the way, you know, their visits to those officials and their wonderful friendships. One of the people that every single traveler visited, almost every single one visited, was Frederick Lugard, whom some of us who are familiar with British colonialism in northern Nigeria know that Frederick Lugard was the one who led the British Imperial Army to conquer northern Nigeria. So he was the one who took away their legitimacy, their independence, who took away their sovereignty. And still, they would speak fondly of him. They would speak of how nice he had been, their wonderful friendship with him, how the lavish entertainment that he gave to them in his house, in his retirement home, because he was already retired back in England at the time. So I found this fascinating on so many levels. To me, it goes against what has been the staple, if you like, of colonial studies, African colonial studies, which is, you know, Muslim colonial subjects in Africa were very antagonistic towards, you know, all kinds of the imperial ideas. They were the staunchest opponents of imperial ideas and imperial cultures. I think these narratives, and I haven't read even half of what I've collected, and I brought more. These narratives tell a slightly different story. They tell a story of Muslim colonial subjects, and I should be careful not to generalize, because these are elite members. If you were to look at the narratives of common folks, it might be different. But at least with these guys, it tells a story of people who proved to be masterful, integrators, if you like, of imperial and Muslim cultures. People who proved to be good uniters of the Western and the Muslim worlds, imperial modernity and African and Muslim modernity. People who transited between those worlds with ease and didn't have any trouble doing that. People who didn't see any contradiction with being Muslim rulers who derived their authority from an Islamic source, whose legitimacy depended on their loyalty to the Islamic traditions of northern Nigeria, and people who at the same time could still function within an imperial world, a British imperial world, and still, you know, admire British imperial culture, they would speak fondly of the palace of the, because some of them were important enough that they were invited to Buckingham Palace. Some of them met the queen, the king or the queen. Those who traveled after Queen Elizabeth came to Paris, they met the queen. Those who traveled earlier met the king, and so on and so forth. So they were not ashamed to talk about their admiration for the British, for the queen, the British crown, for the splendor of the British royal court. They talked about it as being an honor for them to have entered the palace, to have met or shaken hands with the king or the queen. They spoke fondly of those memories. They spoke about the sheep, the restaurants, the food they ate, the zoos, the animals. I mean, they spoke glowingly about these ingredients, if you like, these attributes of imperial culture, in the way that would shock some of us who might think that these were people whose worldview would be irreconcilable with these ingredients of imperial culture. Now let me give you a few examples, because from the ones that I've read, I mean, I'll just give two examples. In one of the narratives, one of the travel narratives, this emir, this Muslim ruler of an emirate, goes to London. In his case, I think he was sponsored. He goes to London, he was sponsored on the trip by the British colonial authorities. He goes to London, he comes back to northern Nigeria, and he publishes the narrative, and I didn't have time to put this, to do digital imagery on this, some of these sources. As you can see, some of it is in Arabic, some of it is in Hausa, most of it is in Hausa. But let me show a picture, because it carries a picture of him, actually. This is all in Hausa, okay. This is the narrative itself. His name is Yahya. It was Yahya because he's dead now. Sarkin Gwanju was the king of Gwanju, the second most important Islamic emirate in northern Nigeria. He was the king of Gwanju. And this is his picture taken on his throne. And so he wrote the narrative, and the narrative was published with his picture in it. And in this narrative, he talks about a lot of things. He talks about his experiences in London, and says clearly, everyone should go to London. That's what he says. Every northern Nigerian should endeavor to go to London, just like every Muslim should endeavor to go to the Holy Land to perform the pilgrimage. He says he likens the London experience, the British experience, to going to London. Everyone should endeavor to do it because it's so important. He says it opens a whole new world to you. And this is the phrase that I like best in the whole narrative. He says, and I'll read it in Hausa and then interpret it. He says, Dunia abrinin London tiki, which basically means that the world begins and ends in London, in the city of London. I'm still trying to unpack this statement, but it's very fascinating in the sense that, you know, and you know, we could do all sorts of things with this statement. In African studies, this statement would most certainly, by most African historians, they would say, oh, this is double consciousness, right? This is double consciousness, this is false consciousness, this is he, you know, just trying to. But I think it's a lot more than that. It's more than double consciousness. I think it shows the extent to which these individuals were not just passive recipients, they were not just passive consumers of imperial cultures, but they were bona fide co-creators of imperial culture. They were contributors to imperial culture. They were not just people who just sat back passively and took what the British gave them. They were people who saw themselves as bona fide members of empire and as contributors to imperial culture. And I think this is where I'm going with this. I don't want to just say it as, oh, okay, this guy got brainwashed and he's just double consciousness, or maybe he was just a beneficiary of the system, which is what, you know, he was an emir, he was being paid by the British. So it's a lot more than that. The second example is, one of the narrators says, Martin Arewa Suje London Suwaye, meaning women of northern Nigeria should go to London to get enlightened. So, I mean, again, I'm just raising questions with this night. I've still not unpacked some of these statements, but I think they are very important. They are very loaded, and they are very pregnant with all kinds of meanings. What does it mean when this guy says the women of Northern Nigeria should go to London to derive enlightenment? You know, so there's all kinds of examples, but the way in which they talk about London and Britain is really fascinating. Finally, let me just talk about what I'm doing with this historiographically and theoretically, where I'm going with it. And I'm just going to raise some tentative points and raise questions. I don't have the answers as yet, this project being very new. One of the things I like to do with this is, you know, lately we've been inundated with this talk about clash of civilizations, the Muslim world being at odds with the Western world, and modernity being something that is unsuited to the Islamic realm. But this narrative, I think, may help me if I, you know, to arrive at a different conclusion, which is that, at least in this particular case, this group of Muslim travelers proved themselves to be people who, you know, who functions within those two walls easily, and people who also brought all the elements of the two walls and united them and made them into a unique sort of culture. Within this culture, they use this culture to validate themselves in the local environment, to gain respect in the eyes of their contemporaries. They used it to cultivate themselves, to cultivate their image as a Muslim colonial elite. Okay, so this is what they used it for. So I think the language of I can use this project maybe to speak to the whole debate about the clash of civilization and the irreconcilability of Muslim culture and Western culture, and the fact that maybe it's more complicated than the idea of the clash of civilizations. The other thing is that maybe we can use these narratives to talk about how these Muslim colonial elites negotiated power within their local environments. I said earlier on that their source of power was Islamic. They derived their power from the traditional Islamic authorities of Northern Nigeria. But in order to reinforce this authority, in order to reinforce their prestige and their status in this society, they needed something more that was not Islamic. In other words, they needed a syncretism. They needed to syncretize the Western realm, ingredients and elements from the Western world with elements from their Islamic source of authority. And they did it masterfully and perfectly. They were able to do this wonderfully. When they went to Britain, sometimes they brought back all kinds of goods. They brought back robes, which they integrated into their traditional wares. They brought back certain kinds of ornaments, which they added to their thrones, to decorate their thrones. And their thrones were, you know, so they had this wonderful way of integrating the two cultures and creating a new one, and validating themselves and adding to their prestige in the process. I want to use this to speak to another issue. There's an author, an African historian, who wrote a book called Colonial Subjects, African Intellectuals and Atlantic Ideas. In this book, he talks about how the coastal elite in colonial Lagos were exposed to Atlantic ideas through the visits of West Indians, black West Indians, African-American intellectuals who visited Lagos in the late 19th century. And sort of, you know, through their ideas and through their public lectures, spurred a political, cultural, and intellectual awakening in this emergent elite in Lagos at the time. And it's a wonderful book, and it's a great, great analysis. And he also talks about how this new emergent colonial elite in Lagos, in southern Nigeria, some of them traveled to England, and when they traveled to England, who were they meeting with? They were meeting with black West Indians, they were meeting with blacks from the Caribbean, black African Americans. Some of them went to the Pan-African Congresses, and they came back to Lagos and sort of used this as an intellectual foundation for their anti-colonial activities. I mean, that is all very wonderful, but you know, this in African studies, this has come to form the basis upon which, you know, we look at colonial elites. And I'm trying to suggest here that with this narrative that maybe there is another, a different kind of black Atlantic, a Muslim black Atlantic, because the black elite that he talks about, the Lagos elite, is mostly Christian, mostly westernized. They went to Western schools. But this is a different kind of black Muslim Atlantic. They traveled to Britain, but when they went to Britain, these guys, these later writers, these people who wrote this narrative, they didn't meet with West Indians. They didn't meet with African Americans. They met with colonial officials. They met with the friends that they had made, the British officials that they had become friends with earlier. They went to the palaces, they went to the zoos. I mean, they belong to completely different circles. Yet, they brought with them all kinds of ideas from Britain. They didn't interact with black Britain the way that the Lagos elite did. Yet, they brought a lot of things back with them to northern Nigeria, which they integrated into their Muslim setting. So maybe we can talk about a different kind of black Atlantic. Finally, okay. Finally, maybe with this narrative, maybe I can make a statement I can make a statement about how, you know, the northern Nigerian Muslim elite viewed colonialism and viewed their position within it, and maybe move away a little bit from the paradigm of dominance and resistance and, you know, Africans simply resisting colonialism, and posit something much more broad, much more embracing of a wide range of responses, of even accommodationist expressions. People who were very accommodationist to colonialism and perfected and made it admirable, and made accommodation and, you know, strategic and pragmatic accommodation admirable and attractive. People who were able to do it successfully. And these groups of people did it successfully. They were Muslims, but at the same time, they functioned within a British, supposedly Christian, imperial world. I'll just stop here because I've taken too much time.
Talking head over the podium. Well, my project is actually a continuation of my first book project, and so it is in a sense cheating. I started a second book that was way too big and too broad, and it was going to take me years of travel. I've already done years of travel on that, and at some point I decided, well, this is maybe more discreet for book two, and then I'll head back to book three. But while searching in the original manuscripts that I was working on for the first book, I found this runaway ad that hooked me, and I've come full circle and have come back. It described a man named Prince, 6 feet high, strong built and brawny, a carpenter by trade, 30 years of age, talkative. His wife, Judy, a smart, active wench, also about 30 or upward, and country born, 5'7" or 8" high, and their children, Glasgow and Polly. Glasgow was 8 years old, a well-looking boy of open countenance and obliging disposition, and Polly was 6 years old, lively eyes, and gently pitted with the pox. And the ad went on to say, it was believed that Prince had carried them off with him to Florida to avoid a separation from his family, to which he's much attached. Well, that little paragraph just grabbed me, and I started thinking about what happened to this family and kept searching for them. And I eventually found Prince. He had crossed into Spanish Florida and had achieved a free status there, but I couldn't find Judy and Polly in Glasgow, and I was bereft. I thought they had been captured, and I worried for a long time about them until I got more comfortable in those documents and saw more and more of them, and eventually realized, well, they've just taken on new names, and they had been baptized as Catholics in Spanish Florida, and they had totally new identities. Well, this is how I started the project. It turned out that Prince went on to have a very important military career in Spanish Florida. He was made a sergeant in the Free Black Militia. He was obviously a leader of his community because he makes a number of petitions on their behalf, even though he's illiterate. Little Glasgow enters the public school there and goes on to become a literate man and takes on an occupation as a shoemaker. And Polly, we don't know if she was educated, but she ends up with a pretty interesting marriage that I followed her through. And I joked in the proposal for this book project, for which I got some funding, that he's basically like a Forrest Gump of his age. He goes through every major event that happens in the 18th century on the Atlantic coast. And so I've started tracking him back to Africa. He probably came out of the port of Ouidah. By looking at the Eltis database, I can track them in the years in which he was enslaved and transported to South Carolina. That was the shipping port. And then he arrives in South Carolina, where he is a slave, and is placed on a plantation. And Judy, it turns out, was on a nearby plantation. They're there about 10 years when the children are born, and the American Revolution breaks out. South Carolina happened to be the bloodiest place that any of the revolutionary battles were fought, and it's basically guerrilla war all over their plantations. Some of you may have seen that really hokey movie, The Patriot, that Mel Gibson did. Well, that's right where they were living, and Frances Marion, the swamp fox that some of you may know from your American history, actually wrote letters from Judy's plantation, which he had occupied. So they're involved in all of that, and somehow they are moved by the loyalists who resisted the revolution farther and farther south. And Lord Dunmore had proclaimed freedom to slaves who wanted to join the British forces. I don't know if Prince did that and took that role voluntarily, or if he was just impressed and moved along. But they finally get to St. Mary's, Georgia, which is the southernmost American port. And there's a little river, small river really, but it's a river, and they had to cross that to get to another country, which was Spanish Florida, owned by Spain at that point. So it's an international border, basically like the Underground Railroad people ran to cross into Canada, these people run to cross into Florida. And after four tries, they finally make it, and that's how I encountered them in the records, because they end up in Spanish Florida. Well, why were they made free in Spanish Florida? That question arose. And in tracking back into the Spanish history, I read a wonderful book by Peter Wood, Black Majority, about South Carolina. And the big slave revolt in South Carolina was the Stono slave revolt in 1739. Everybody was running south, and I wondered, why are they going south? It turns out the same reason Prince and all the people in the Revolutionary War period were going south, because Spain had established in 1693 a royal decree freeing any slave who came from a Protestant area and crossed into a Catholic area and wanted to be free and know the true faith. And so hundreds of people had come in the earlier period, which I look at, and I've done some work with archaeologists there on the first free black settlement in what is today the United States, which incidentally, yesterday, Jeb Bush made a big production about, and they had a big event and made it, it's a historic landmark. We've raised money for it. It's off the development screen, and now they're making a museum there. So finally, that's interesting. But that was an earlier precedent, and it's still in place when the American Revolution breaks out. So Prince and 250 others that I can account for claimed their freedom on this religious sanctuary basis. And Prince takes on a leading role. He's not the only important person in the community, but he is a leader, and becomes a military man, a property man, has a business, and ends up filing a lot of petitions in the name of the community for land and for favors and privileges from the Spanish government. So in many ways, it's like Moses's people, who find a way to work within the system that you ordinarily would expect by the traditional narrative. Everybody revolts and so on, but sometimes revolution is suicide, and sometimes there are better ways to look at it, and we imagine some sorts of solidarity based on skin color that weren't there in the periods that we're studying. So everybody made different choices, and some ran instead to the Seminole Nation and took up free lives in the interior there. Prince connects to all of those people as well, because in the military, often they were posted in the black Seminole villages, and so some of the other free English-speaking slaves who ran and became free in Spanish Florida end up also settled out with the Seminoles. And it's sort of an interesting aberration or offshoot from the traditional narrative of the American Revolution, because it all impacts there by the incoming populations that fled from the Loyalists. British were in Florida for a while, but by the time Prince is coming in, it has returned to Spanish hands. So he has a pretty good long life there. I estimate if he was enslaved maybe at age 20, maybe had a decade in South Carolina when he's married and has the children, and then 35 years or more of his life are spent in Spanish Florida. In those times, they learn Spanish, they become Catholics, they start communities. The little boy grows up. Glasgow is now Francisco, and Polly is now Maria, and Francisco, the little boy, is also in the militia. They're all intermarrying each other. I can follow that through marriage records and baptismal records. Godparentage networks are building up. Militia records give me some more evidence, property records. So it's really wonderful that we just have this great archive sitting there that allows us that insight into a world we wouldn't know much. I've picked up more things in Spain and in Cuba, even in Mexico, because the economy was tied to Mexico too, and lots in the U.S. archives, because at the time that all this is happening, Thomas Jefferson is Secretary of State, and he's worried about the outflow of slaves from the southern colonies and knows it's a potential real problem for them. So he pressures Spain. The diplomatic resolution is end that sanctuary, or else in 1790 they post the announcement, it's all shut down. But everybody that was there up until that time is still free, and probably more also came in under the wire or past the date. And so we have a really interesting community of English-speaking people who fled from the American Revolution, may have been on the side of the Loyalists, but have taken up now a Spanish identity, a Catholic identity, and a free life. Well, other revolutions, this is the era of revolutions, other revolutions are happening too. So the French Revolution breaks out, and right to the south of us in Florida was Saint-Domingue and the great slave revolt there. When all the British and the French armies come in there, the Spanish are also dickering with all the leaders of the slave revolt to try to come over to their side, and in fact some of them do. Toussaint Louverture was only underneath another man who was named Georges Biassou, who ends up in Spanish Florida. He took the Spanish deal, he comes into St. Augustine, and it's his heir apparent, his dedicated heir, who marries Maria. Little Polly ends up marrying into the Haitian slave revolt leadership. And, you know, the citizens of Spanish Florida and of South Carolina and Georgia are not happy about the incoming Haitian rebels who've just been involved in these long, bloody wars. But in a sense, I can think of that as the episode probably that ends up triggering a lot more American intervention. So Prince is now involved in the life and thought about the French Revolution and the Haitian Revolution, as well as the American Revolution. In the meantime, Seminole Wars, Patriot invasions from Georgia, he's in every one of these episodes, and you think he has to constantly be thinking about the meanings of freedom, because his whole life has gone through these changes about which system can he best operate in. And at the end, it's pretty evident that Spain is weakening and they're going to lose the grip on Florida, because Thomas Jefferson and every other president after that is going to want Florida and pressure them to give it up. And Spain has its hands full with revolutions all over the world, all over its empire, and Florida's not worth much to them, and they don't want to alienate the U.S., so eventually they're going to give it up. And then all of the people of color who had been now free citizens under the Spanish are going to have to risk staying under the new regime, the U.S. territorial regime, and see if they stick to their promises about allowing them to stay free, just as their fellows were in New Orleans and Louisiana, having to make that decision. When the Americans come in, do I stick here where I've built up my home, where my children have grown up, or do I try another reinvention of my life in another place? And Prince and his fellows decide to take that risk and to move to Cuba, Spanish Cuba, in 1821. The Americans are coming in. It's pretty clear they're not going to be lenient on race relations. And so another exodus. And Prince and everybody get on these ships and they go off to Cuba in 1821. The timing was dicey for them, however, because even though Spanish law should have been the same all over and they should have been welcomed and free in Cuba, and they were, but the Haitian slave revolt scared all of Cuba. It means sugar kicks in big scale in Cuba, too, as all the plantations burn in Saint-Domingue, everybody transfers over to Cuba, and a huge African importation had happened from the 1790s forward into Cuba. So Cuba has become Africanized
as this war in the north is going on. And so when Prince and the fellows and that big community comes in there, they're expecting to have the same rights and privileges that they've won in Florida, and they have them. But I've been working in Cuba lately, and a lot of military commissions in Havana and in the new sugar regions in Matanzas are cracking down on free blacks, associating in large numbers. The military are under suspicion. Religious brotherhoods are being broken into and arrested, basically, if they have too many people. So I see a crackdown happening in Cuba, which culminates in a series of very big slave revolts known as, the big one is 1843 La Escalera, a really bloody, horrible thing in which they almost wipe out the whole free black community of Cuba. There's a massive deportation. I've been reading in the Cuban records they give them 15 days to make some sort of claim about why they should be allowed to stay or else they're out of Cuba. And so they are a new diaspora of dispersal. And these people, some of the elites who have been managing, as Moses has pointed out, to make accommodations with the colonial system, have, godfathers in the white Spanish community and so on, they get enough people to write petitions on their behalf that they're allowed to stay. And so some can stick it out. But others are deported. The poorer people are deported. They go all over the world. They get sent to Mexico, to Brazil, to Jamaica, back to Africa. And amazingly, about 40 people end up going back to the United States. And this is in the 1840s when, race relations have totally changed in the U.S. I'm thinking, I haven't tracked everybody everywhere because I'm only getting going on this, but I'm thinking that if they went anywhere in the U.S., you would either go to Louisiana or Florida, where before you had known a life among the Spanish or the French and it had some rights and had some property, still had personal connections to reestablish yourself back there. And so I don't know if any of you have had the chance to read the wonderful little book about Anna Kingsley, the African woman from Senegal who became a plantation mistress in Florida, and she's part of all of this diaspora. She and her daughters come back from Saint-Domingue and fight through the American courts in the 1870s to get back property and reestablish themselves. So there's a long persistence that we weren't really aware of, I think, in Florida. Everybody's pretty aware of the Creole population in Louisiana, but I don't believe people have paid so much attention to this very interesting and international group, mixed group of people fleeing from an American Revolution, people involved in the French Revolution because there are French revolutionaries who invade Florida too, from the Haitian revolutionary group that come in, from all of these filibusters from the Latin American independence movements who also end up in there. And all of them every day were living through, trying to tangle with the ideas of liberty and revolution and constitutional rights and return of absolutism, all of these things. They're living and working and trying to figure their best options. So that's my project on Prince. And so if I ever get any time, I'm going to work on this book. In the meantime, I sort of have, at least I got some funding and it's on its way, and I'll return to it eventually. And I think rather than show those images, maybe we'll just let everybody talk. And then if you want to see some images later, we'll do them. Okay, thanks.
Well, I see my own responsibility as not to stand in the way between of your questions and my colleagues on the panel, so I promise to be brief. Actually, I'm here mainly to celebrate African and African-American history here at Vanderbilt, and to also kind of underscore, and for some of you this won't be necessary, what is particularly historical about the works, the three works that you heard about. First, as part of the celebration, you heard just a sample of ongoing work here at Vanderbilt that captures the wide array of scholarship. So I just want to remind you that there's plenty more happening here just within my own department, the Department of History. So I just want to highlight work that Richard Blackett has done and is doing. He has worked long and hard on English and transatlantic movements, abolitionist movement in particular, and is currently working on resistance to the fugitive slave law in northern communities. David Colton's work on the South, especially the New South, of course, provides context, the all-important material and economic context for African-American experiences over a long span of time. Another senior scholar, Dennis Dickerson, has been remarkably versatile in his work, starting with a social history of black steelworkers in western Pennsylvania, to a biography of a national civil rights leader, Whitney Young, to his current study of religion and pre-civil rights black leadership. Devin Fergus is busily completing a cutting-edge study of the complicated relationship between political liberalism and black activism, using the Piedmont area of North Carolina as a case study. And our newest colleague, Catherine Molyneux, who is here, promises to enrich our early American and Atlantic world scholarship, as well as curriculum on slavery and race. She is demonstrating the central role that imagery and ideology played in the evolution of the British Empire. So that's more of a sample of what's underway within and around our department. You heard some wonderful examples of how historians not only use documents in a particular way with a certain kind of discipline, but also how through subtle analysis they transcend and challenge mythologies and generalizations. So I just want to kind of underscore that for each of these projects. Anastasia Kerwood tested somewhat familiar definitions of family and gender roles, using familiar intellectuals, writers like Toomer and Fraser, even film, and of course, less familiar new Negro feminists. They provided definitions, and that's kind of relatively accessible, has been for a long time for historians, but for a long time, historians stopped there. And of course, added to our understanding of the new Negro and the movement, especially in the 1920s. But what Kerwood's work is doing is reaching a deeper level, as she called it, the inner lives of ordinary people, as well as intellectuals and leaders. And it's that kind of access that is putting to the test a lot of generalizations and misunderstandings about the new Negro movement, while adding to our understanding of American society and culture more broadly. Moses Achonu, Anastasia gave us a wonderful Valentine in her work. Moses gave us, I thought, even though he's jet-lagged, a quite energetic unpacking of questions. The historian unpacking his questions, you know, from his archival work in Nigeria. And there, again, he's using something that historians have worked with for a long, long time, travel writings. But in this case, it's kind of the reverse of what historians settled for. Often when we think of African history, we think of European travel writings, and we use that to understand what the Europeans thought, and sometimes we misuse it to understand what Africans themselves were doing. Well, in this case, you know, we have really, in Moses Ochono's work, we're going way past that. And we're looking at this group of northern Nigerian Muslims who travel to Britain. And through their writings, he is beginning to explain what he called working the colonial system. And that's all about agency, rather than the passivity that has dominated so much of the history. So he is testing these familiar concepts, double or false consciousness, clash of civilizations. This is another example of how historians using familiar and less familiar documents challenge our assumptions. Jane Landers starts with a runaway ad. And all too many historians over the years stopped with runaway ads. You know, they used runaway ads to kind of get a sense of how many slaves were trying to run away, the process of retrieval. Well, she did far more. She started with this runaway ad and pursued the lives of Winton and his family only possible because of her ability to reach so many kinds of documents in so many places in multiple languages. So she was able to follow these lives and piece them together, their experiences together. And here, challenging assumptions about boundaries and borders, she is revealing to us how Africans and African Americans defied borders and boundaries by literally crossing them, but also liberating themselves through this risky movement and their skillful negotiation. So here, they're forging new identities even, as well as new networks. And I would say that what I heard resonating from Ochonu's work to Lander's work is working the system. And in this case, they're working the imperial system or the rivalry between empires. So as you can tell, I'm quite delighted by this work and will follow these projects with great interest, and I hope you have some reactions yourselves. Thank you.